3:35, we have Senator Stedman, Senator Wilkowski, Senator Green, Senator McGuire, and myself, Charlie Huggins. And today, we will continue after the pipeline shutdown, update on corrosion from the state. Online, we have with us today Mike Usler and Tony Brock. Are you there, Mike and Tony?
Not available.
Not available?
That's correct.
I'm not familiar with those names.
For the BP guys.
Oh, the BP guys, okay.
Yeah.
BP guys, yep. Okay.
And Kathy Forrester?
And Kathy Forrester, are you there?
Yes, I am.
Okay.
And Kevin Banks.
Yeah, Ken and Breck.
Director Kevin Banks from the Division of Oil and Gas should also
be on. Kevin, are you online?
Not yet.
Okay. Well, in the intermediate, in the interest of time, Larry, if you would kick off and give us a quick review of where we were last Friday, and we'll go from there. And before we continue on, I would just say thanks to you. I know this is a holiday, President's Day, but, you know, we're doing business. And I say thanks to you for President of the Senate and all Alaskans. Thanks. And if you would just put yourself on the record again.
Okay. For the record, my name is Larry Dietrich with the Alaska Department of Environmental Conservation, Division of Spill Prevention and Response. Mr. Chairman, yeah, just real quickly, I won't go through. I was just about done, I think, when we adjourned on Friday.
Excuse me, Larry. Senator Dyson? Senator Dyson, would you like to join us right here?
Thank you, but I may have to leave in a
okay.
half hour.
All right, good enough. Well, thanks for joining us.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Chairman. Yeah. Just to sum up real quickly, I just covered what the new regulatory framework will be for the pipelines on the North Slope following the spill at both the state and federal level. And if I can summarize it in a very short way, it simply means that the state will be regulating the flow lines upstream of the production facilities, and the federal government Office of Pipeline Safety will be regulating them downstream. The last topic, which if you have your passouts, would begin on page 15. It just was my last subject, and it just covers the status of the two cleanups at the two events from last summer, the GC2 spill and the FS2 spill. That's Flow Station 2 spill and Gathering Center 2 spill. A cleanup at both sites was completed last summer. There will be additional monitoring and restoration if needed next summer. Impacts of both of the spill sites are de minimis. There were no wildlife impacts. These are very manageable cleanup events for us on the North Slope because of the flat terrain, and we have the second largest oil spill co-op in the state on the North Slope, Alaska Clean Seas. And they have considerable assets, staffing 24/7, and we have about any kind of equipment you would want to have for an event. It's located at Prudhoe, so we're very well equipped up there. Just turning the sheet to page 16 real quick. This is a part of the cleanup in the winter at the GC2 site. They did some new, they're always trying new techniques for cleanup on the tundra, and they used a trimmer at this particular site, then followed by actual brushing activity. So the trimmer goes in and it kind of trims up all the frozen oil particles on the upper layer, and then they're brushed up following that with a conventional steel brush. And then on page 17, here's a shot of the restoration activities at the Gathering Center 2 site. Total disturbed area here was 2.3. And you can see a little bit the areas of re-veg that are coming back. And then finally on page 18 is a close-up of one of the re-veg areas. So the site is recovering according to expectations at this point, but we'll continue to monitor it in the future.
Who actually did the cleanup?
Mr. Chairman, the companies have a spill co-op on the slope called Alaska Clean Seas, who conduct most of the operations on behalf of the companies. So the companies take responsibility. They pay for the cleanup. They oversee the cleanup. They have an incident commander working in the unified command that directs the cleanup activities on their behalf. And then most of the work is actually carried out then through Alaska Clean Seas and its contractors.
Do you know what the dollar amount was?
Mr. Chairman, no, I do not know the company investment into the cleanup.
Yeah. I think it's, well, I know it's of interest to, you know, what, I mean, who does it, what it cost us, mm-hmm. and the time involved, because, I mean, our experience base, so we can anticipate if we hopefully don't have the occurrence again, but if we do, so we'd be interested in that.
Yeah. Mr. Chairman, the actual cost on those are usually difficult for us to get because with the upgrades and the financial responsibility and the spill planning and preparedness since the early 90s, most companies anymore assume responsibility right at the outset. And we have no requirement where they conduct a cleanup for them to report what they expend to us. We do keep track, of course, of the state costs that are invested into it. But we have no mechanism by which that is routinely reported to us.
Stand by for a moment. Is there anybody from BP online?
There is, Mr. Chairman. Tony Brock.
Yeah, Tony, can you give us that number?
I don't have the number at mind right now, Mr. Chairman, but I can get that number for you.
Okay, thank you. Okay, questions? All right, go ahead.
That concludes my remarks, and thank you very much for your time.
Any additional questions? Okay. Tony?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. For the record, I'm Joni Slimmons. I'm the acting coordinator for the Petroleum Systems Integrity Office. The state pipeline coordinator, Mike Thompson, could not be with us today, either in person or on the line, and I will be making his presentation for him. I believe you should have received an abbreviated presentation, somewhat shorter than the one passed out last Wednesday, but one that still hits the primary points that needed to be covered.
Could you hold the cover up so we can tell which one
yes,
you're talking
sir.
About? Okay. Okay. Okay, go ahead.
On behalf, then, of Mike Thompson, the State Pipeline Coordinator, I would just mention that the State Pipeline Coordinator's office is a consortium of state agencies. It is physically located with the Joint Pipeline Office in Anchorage. The state agencies represented are the Department of Natural Resources, the Department of Environmental Conservation, Labor and Workforce Development, and Public Safety. If you include all of those agencies, in addition to the Bureau of Land Management, then you have the team that forms the Joint Pipeline Office. The State Pipeline Office has jurisdiction over those pipelines on state rights of way. Alaska Statute 3835, the Right of Way Leasing Act, provides the relevant authorities. And on the second page of the presentation, you'll see a listing of the various pipelines over which the State Pipeline Coordinator's Office exercises jurisdiction. Just as a point of interest, on the North Slope, this represents approximately 375 miles of pipeline. In South Central Alaska, it represents somewhere between 110 and 135 miles of pipeline. At the very bottom, you'll see the Trans-Alaska Pipeline System, and of course, that's the joint effort between the state and the federal government. Moving on then, looking back to the shutdown of the Prudhoe Bay unit, which actually was a partial shutdown of the Western Operating Unit and a full shutdown of the Eastern Operating Unit. The business resumption and replacement projects, the State Pipeline Coordinator's Office does have experience in pipeline oversight, and those resources, most particularly the engineers at the State Pipeline Coordinator's Office, were made available to assist both with the immediate emergency and with the long-term response. DNR, DEC, and AOGCC formed the Arctic Pipeline Technology Team in response to direction from the Murkowski administration after the March spill. And that team has continued to meet and continued throughout the August spill as well. Staff from the State Pipeline Coordinator's Office were assigned to the APTT, and they have contributed right along. The State Pipeline Coordinator's Office did provide assistance as well to the Division of Oil and Gas in the development of long-term oil and gas infrastructure oversight program, and I will be addressing that later when I do my own presentation at the end. The SPCO also facilitated information sharing regarding the August shutdown, And those meetings were instrumental, I believe, in providing coordination of corrective actions, and not to mention just this information sharing status. Those meetings, on the following page, you can see the participants. There's a broad group of participants, both state and federal agencies, as well as municipalities and industry. At first, those meetings were held on a weekly basis, immediately after the August spill. After several months, they went to a monthly basis, and just recently have gone to bi-monthly. The next meeting will be held the first week of April on the 4th. Various subjects were addressed in these coordination meetings, including, initially, the oil spill response itself, the oil transit line bypasses, the oil transit pipeline's corrosion monitoring processes, the Prudhoe Bay Unit oil transit line's replacement project, a major project, and TAPS-related issues. When the Prudhoe Bay Unit experienced the shutdown, it did have repercussions for the Trans-Alaska pipeline system in terms of low throughput and associated vibration impacts and so forth. Specific actions by the SPCO included an engineering review and approval of the jumper line hot taps on the Endicott pipeline bypass, and various issues related to the Tank 110 sediment management. Tank 110 is located near Pump Station 1 or at Pump Station 1 of TAPS. And again, the TAPS low throughput issues that I mentioned before, vibration issues at the Attigan Pass, Isabel and Thompson passes, the accuracy of leak detection, physical changes of the crude oil itself, operational impacts generally, and then turbines operating at too low power. I would mention, Mr. Chairman, if I might, that we have in the audience Louis Kozacek, who is an engineer, the lead engineer for the State Pipeline Coordinator's Office, and he is available to answer any specific questions, especially those of a technical nature, regarding the engineering review and the immediate spill response efforts of the State Pipeline Coordinator's Office. Louis Kozacek. He's sitting directly behind me.
Yeah, Louis, could you come up so we could hear from you very quickly? You need to be able to be heard through the microphone. Now, as I understand it, put yourself on the record.
Okay. Louis Kozacek, I'm the chief engineer for the State Pipeline Coordinator's Office.
Louis, just so we get the concept correct, Mike Thompson heads up the office, is that correct?
That's right.
Right. And could you tell us roughly what the organization is?
The State Pipeline Coordinator has a rights-of-way department answering to him, along with the engineering department and administrative department, and also has about five to six liaisons from different agencies report both to him and back to their own agencies.
So, and roughly how many people were we talking about in the office?
Roughly about 25.
Right. And you're housed in Anchorage, is that correct?
That's correct.
Is there any representation here in Juneau?
No.
No. Okay. New office, old office, been around since TAPS went?
It's been around since TAPS was constructed, probably started during the construction era in the late 1970s. It was a small office in Fairbanks during the 1980s, and then it had a renewed focus and increased staffing after the Exxon Valdez incident. And at that point, it was moved to Anchorage in order to be part of the Joint Pipeline Office.
Right. And who does Mr. Thompson report to?
He reports to Ed Vogels, the Assistant Commissioner, DNR, Ed Vogels. And recently, I believe they may have had a change. He also reports to Marty Rutherford.
So he reports to two people?
Well, I think technically he...
Yeah, I mean, that's okay. Just so we know what the chain of command is. I mean, I'm not trying to pin you down. If it's a deputy commissioner, that's fine. That's fine. Any questions about the yes, Senator Wilkowski?
Well, this is on is a jurisdictional question, and I think I know the answer, but I just want to make sure. Is it fair to say that all the pipelines, the transit lines, all the lines up on the North Slope now are under either state or federal jurisdiction for review?
I believe that would be correct. The DOT, the U.S. DOT, is, since the spill, has essentially been acting with the authority that the transit oil pipelines are under their review, and they are currently promulgating new rules and regulations that would place them permanently under their review. I'm not exactly sure of what status the permanent rules and regulations are in, but for all intents and purposes, they now have a great deal of oversight from the U.S. DOT.
And if, I don't know if this is you're the appropriate person to talk about this or not, but what are the lessons to be learned here? I mean, where did we go wrong? What went wrong here that caused these pipes to get so corroded to the point that they began leaking?
Well, I think I can only offer you personal opinions, or I don't think there has been any sort of definitive conclusion drawn, but my opinion is that leaving the solids in the pipeline was the major contributing factor.
If I could just follow up.
Yes.
I'm new to the committee. Can you explain that to me, leaving the solids in the line?
Okay. All oil reservoirs have some sort of sediments that are produced with them, along with paraffins and asphaltenes that tend to drop out of solution. Paraffins are just waxes. Asphaltenes are what they sound like, asphaltic type substances. And those tend to plate the insides of a pipe after a while, and if not removed, they can contribute to corrosion in a number of ways. First of all, corrosion inhibitor is a chemical that's added, injected into the oil, and the solids can absorb the corrosion inhibitor. Also, the corrosion inhibitor keeps solids keep corrosion inhibitors from contacting the metal of the pipe, simply because they are sediment. They provide a sort of a safe harbor for the bacteria in the bottom of the pipe, where the growth rates can be accelerated by essentially changing the environment. Solids can cause a type of corrosion called microbial-induced corrosion, and essentially those exhibit it in sort of a pinholing type corrosion, like we saw at the leak, where essentially a pocket of bacteria is allowed to stay there, and then it works its way through corroding the steel.
Thank you.
It's probably more detail than you wanted.
Just one quick follow-up.
Yes.
Have scientists known about this effect, or is this something that we're just learning about in recent years?
It's been well known, but there's a considerable debate about how active the corrosion is in different locations, in different types of crude oil. So it's a well-known process, but how potent it is essentially in creating corrosion is unique to the circumstances.
Thank you.
Question for you on how you see the organization that you work in. Are you a compliance organization? Are you an enforcement agency? Do people see you as scientists running around with magnifying glass and a helpful hand with white suits on? What do you see?
Technically speaking, we're not. The SPCO's office is not truly a regulatory organization. It is more of a monitoring and oversight organization because our authority comes through administering leases, essentially monitoring the installation of the longer distance pipelines on state land. Those pipelines are authorized under a rather specialized statute, 3835, which was created just for pipeline leases.
Right. If you were to characterize over the last 12 months what you did to create a better environment or a safer environment or a compliance or an enforcement, whatever function you had, what would you say? Top three things that you, as part of a team?
Increased communication, discussions about causes of the spills, and essentially providing assistance. The State Pipeline Coordinator's Office really had and today has no authority on the transit pipelines. Our work our authority starts on TAPS, and we simply entered the action when we were attempting to help out. We had people available to talk to BP and monitor the situation and sort of provide oversight and communication and discussion with the other agencies.
So if when you knock on the door at BP, as an example, and you go walking in, are the people saying, we're glad to have you, we need your help, or are they saying, oh, my goodness, we're hoping you wouldn't come today? What sort of reception? What's your image when you look at the industry?
Well, I think it's complicated. Sometimes you have different reactions. But after the oil spill in August, BP made a concerted effort to open their doors to us, and I was over there quite a bit of time, and they allowed me to look at anything I wanted to during that period of time.
Right. If you were king for a day in the pipeline coordination office, you're going to make two changes you think would make it work better. What would they be?
You mean to avoid corrosion in the future like this?
Your mission, your task.
I guess I would attempt to institute more frequent maintenance pigging on the pipelines to remove the solids and then also engage some sort of a integrated corrosion oversight that would look at maintenance pigging, corrosion inhibitors, biocides, other corrosion control techniques, smart pigging, and external and internal direct assessment of corrosion to ensure that you have a safe and reliable pipeline system.
Right. And from your perspective as a professional in the organization, is it within your comfort zone, the progress we've made and where we're headed? Do you have any concerns in that respect?
So far, no. You know, there's a lot of unknowns for the future, but I think the creation of an oversight group, the new DEC regulations, will go a long way toward preventing what happened last summer.
Yeah. Now, the oversight group, I assume you're talking about the Petroleum Systems Integrity Office, is that?
Yes.
Okay. And which organization, are you subordinate to the pipeline office coordinator?
Mr. Chairman, no, I am not. I work through the Division of Oil and Gas.
Okay. Any other questions? Yes, sir.
Just do you feel, the pipeline is getting older, do you feel that we're doing, and the producers and the owners of the pipeline are doing everything that we need to do to maintain the integrity of the pipeline. Pipelines, I should say. Or are there things that we need to do legislatively to make sure that we maintain that integrity?
I don't think that I can really adequately answer that question, because it is a balance. You know, you could pour many hundreds of millions or billions of dollars into the pipeline system up there, and that would probably make them uneconomical to produce. So you have to strike a correct balance between between preventive maintenance on the equipment and pipelines, and cost effectiveness. And I think that I'm relatively comfortable with the progress I've seen, and if it continues into the future, I think that we will strike a good balance there.
Okay, additional questions? Thank you. Sorry to call you out of the audience and ask you a question maybe out of your lane a little bit, but we appreciate your indulging us, and we may have some additional questions for Mr. Thompson, but we appreciate your standing up and taking responsibility.
Mr. Chairman, with your permission, we'll now hear from Commissioner Forster, who is on the line from the Alaska Oil and Gas Conservation Commission.
Thank you, Ms. Forster. If you would put your, Kathy, if you'd put yourself on the record, and we're prepared to hear your testimony.
Okay. My name is Kathy Forster. I'm the Engineering Commissioner at the Alaska Oil and Gas Conservation Commission, and I'll be speaking from a thin set of black and white handouts that I submitted to you guys last week that says, after the 2006 Prudhoe Basin Found Corrective Actions and Oversight, AOGCC role. Everybody found that?
We have that. Thank you. Go ahead.
Okay. Well, using the vernacular of the chair last week, I think I remember you referring to a Mr. Technical and a Mr. Field. Well, given that vernacular, then I'd like you guys to think of me as misunderstood. That was your chance to laugh. because with oil and gas in our title, we get invited to participate in a whole lot of things that may or may not be in our oversight. So let me just start out by explaining what our primary areas of oversight via the statutes are. And they're on that second page. First, we are to prevent resource waste and encourage greater ultimate recovery. Second, we work with the EPA on the Class II Underground Injection Control Program to protect fresh groundwaters during oil and gas operations. Three, we protect correlative rights of hydrocarbon owners. And four, we ensure good oilfield practices are used in drilling, workover, and reservoir management operations. Given that as our areas of responsibility, let me turn you to the next page and hit what our responsibilities are in the areas of pipeline integrity. We are the agency charged with ensuring the accuracy of custody transfer meters. That's the cash register. So the meters that are used by the Department of Revenue, we ensure, or the information that's used from the meters by the Department of Revenue, we ensure that they have the accuracy required by the American Petroleum Institute to make sure that we're getting every penny that we're supposed to get. And as far as pipeline integrity goes, that is the sum total of our oversight responsibility. Okay, so now that I'm no longer misunderstood, let's move to the next page, and I'll tell you what our involvement has been in the huge effort in response to the Prudhoe Basin bill.
Kathy, just a moment. Charlie Huggins here. Let me ask you a question on custody transfer meter accuracy. Is that as simple as having the meter calibrated? Okay.
And we, our inspectors periodically test those meters to ensure that they remain calibrated accurately enough.
Okay. Thank you.
It sounds a lot sexier than it is. That's all it is.
You said that. I didn't. Okay. Thank you.
I'm sorry. So in this bill, we stay apprised of all the operating conditions and remedial plans and actions because, you know, going back to being misunderstood, we get a lot of calls whenever there's anything that happens in the state. And so when a reporter or a concerned citizen calls and says, what's going on, it doesn't comfort them if we say, it's not my job. So we try to stay apprised so that we can say, well, here's what I know, and if you need to know more about this, that, or the other, call BP, call the Joint Pipeline Office, call the you see what I'm saying? We try to be a good answerer to those questions that we get that may not be within our authority. And we also keep informed so that if hydrocarbons are at risk of being lost, that we can step in and engage. You know, for example, there was concern that from the extended shutdown of the Prudhoe Bay wells that there might be some hydrocarbon loss, and so we did an evaluation of that. So the second thing that we did was we were heavily involved in all of the rerouting insofar as custody transfer metering went. Anytime that a line was decommissioned and a new line had to be used, if there was a custody transfer meter in that line, we had to be there to make sure that the new meter or the modifications to an existing meter met all of our requirements. And as you heard earlier, we also provided technical support to the Arctic Pipeline Technology Team. One of our engineers has been an active member in that team. Now, if all you want to hear about is the pipeline, I can stop right here. But if you wanted to hear what other regulatory things that we've been doing since mid-2006, I have two more pieces of paper, it's your choice.
Yeah, continue on.
Okay. In the things that we do regulate, since the middle of 2006, we have put some new blowout preventer equipment regulations into place. And those were primarily to reflect changes in equipment technology and changes in operating enhancements that have happened since the last time the regulations were updated. There wasn't a problem, it was just keeping up with technology. And along those same lines, we're in the process of developing new safety valve system regulations that should come out later this year. And again, keeping up with equipment technology advances is the main impetus behind that. We are trying to contract someone to start a gas disposition's a fancy term for using the gas for something other than sales, such as flaring. And we have very specific rules and procedures that we use to monitor flaring, and they're out of date as well, so we're going to look at updating those. I'm sure most of you know that we have been involved in a Prudhoe Bay gas offtake study in anticipation of a gas pipeline. Now, why are we doing that so far in advance? Because before anyone will put their money into a gas pipeline, they need to know that they will be allowed to produce the gas. Prudhoe Bay is an oil field, and in an oil field, you don't typically get permission to produce the gas till all the oil is gone. And so we're working in a cooperative study with the Prudhoe Bay owners to help us determine what an acceptable allowable will be when we do have a gas pipeline. And we have completed the primary technical efforts of that study, and in our February 28th public meeting, we will be discussing the results of that study. We have a confidentiality agreement with the owners. We want to maintain their trust, so we will not sharing any more than they and we feel is appropriate to share at this time, because we may need to go back and do more studies. These are forecasts, and as time goes on, you need to upgrade your forecasts with existing activities. So February 28th, there should be some information out on the Prudhoe Bay gas offtake study. We also initiated a Point Thompson gas allowable study, but we got out of the chute on that study just about the time that the DNR declared Exxon in default on those Point Thompson leases. So we've kind of put that study on hold for a bit because Exxon's got bigger fish to fry than letting us come over and look at their reservoir models. So that one's waiting to be done. We hired an inspector to replace one of our inspectors who retired, and we are in the process of trying to hire a sixth inspector to manage all of our North Slope and Cook Inlet inspection operations. These inspectors test the safety valve systems to make sure they work. They test the blowout preventer equipment to make sure it works. They do the meter, custody transfer meter testing, and they just travel around keeping track of things just in general to make sure good oil field practices are being used. And sometimes we stick our nose in places that aren't really our responsibility, but we'll just say, hey, that doesn't look right to me. Why don't you go take a look at it? And if we see something that DEC needs to be given a call on, we certainly call them. But that's, those are the kinds of things that our inspectors do.
Kathy, that, excuse me, Charlie Huggins again. You're talking about two inspectors? One.
We have five.
Okay.
At any one time, we try to have two on the slope and one in the inlet. And they do rotations. They're on for 7 days and then off for a bit. But there are five inspectors, and we try to have two on the slope. We have a minimum of one at all times, but we try to have two.
Yeah, I'm looking at your handout. Your handout says additional inspector. Did you have four, and you're now rounding up to five by hiring an additional? Is that what
we
that means?
We had five, and when the fifth one told us he was going to retire, before he retired, we started a hiring process. And so as he went out the door, a replacement came in the door. So we never really dropped below five. But in our budget, we have approval to hire a sixth. And activity level is pretty high, and we have agreed. We work pretty hard to try to keep our budget as lean as we feel it should be. But we've decided that a sixth inspector for all the North Slope and all the Cook Inlet operations, and with us getting ready to be in other places as well, a sixth inspector was not out of line. So we are in the process of trying to hire a sixth inspector right now.
Okay, thank you.
You're welcome. And there was the last big regulatory thing that we've been involved in. There was a series of allegations of well integrity, well cellar integrity, and just general environmental protection by BP in their North Slope wells. We conducted an investigation over the winter, and the DEC participated with us in this investigation. We hired an independent investigator because part of the allegation was that DEC and AOGCC were complicit in allowing BP to violate our regs. So we hired someone who wasn't one of our own, and so he had a fresh set of eyes, went up there and looked at over 100 wells and well cellars and interviewed people face-to-face, and then provided a questionnaire for all of the BP's North Slope operators to submit anonymously, and they got over 50% response to that. We have completed the investigation, and we published a report. It's available on our website, and that is another topic that will be discussed at our February 28th open meeting. So the last page, the key findings of that well integrity investigation. Although we found some housekeeping issues, we did not find any violations of AOGCC regulations. We did identify jointly with the DEC that there is a regulatory gap in well cellar requirements. And we're working with the DEC. They're taking the lead on that, filling that gap, because they've already started to do that before this investigation came up, and they're going to keep working on that with a little help from us as they ask for it. And one thing that came of this that you guys are going to hear about first, nobody's heard about this. In an earlier job, I was the construction manager for a project, and we invited Alaska OSHA to come in and do a friendly audit. And when they do that, they give you a get-out-of-jail-free card. If they find any violations that aren't life-threatening or criminally awful, they'll just say, hey, that ladder needs to have an additional rung, or that ditch needs to be 6 inches shallower, fix that, and we're going to come back in 30 days and check on you, and we're going to bring our ticket book, and if you didn't fix all these things we found, we're going to start giving you tickets and making you pay fines. So we don't do that, and we are bouncing it around within the AOGCC to decide whether that's something that we want to make available to operators, so that rather than wait for someone to send a frustrated, angry letter saying you guys aren't doing your job, that we make this available as a way that we can get up there and walk around and you know, peek in a few places that we don't ordinarily peek in, and as an opportunity to help the operators out. And we are going to invite other agencies that would like to participate in that with us to do so. So I'm done.
Okay. Thanks, Kathy. Questions for Kathy? Kathy, I'm going to back up on your slides very quickly. And on your AOGCC oversight of pipeline integrity slide, you essentially, if you interpret this, your duty is calibrating meters. And your slide says no other authority. Is there anything else you want to add there? I mean, I hate to say it, but that's a little bit of an understatement. I'm not sure how many people you have doing that.
the five inspectors that do all of those other things, that is one of the tasks that they perform. And there is a schedule for when those meters need to be checked. But those guys do a heck of a lot of other things. They test blowout preventer equipment on every drilling rig that's up there at least every other week. They check every safety valve system on every single well that's up on the slope. They do other drive around, check well sites. They do a lot of things in addition to that. So when I say that's all we do, that's a small fraction of what a couple of people do while they're doing a lot of other things.
Okay. If, quote, whistleblower wants to get in touch with somebody in AOGCC, how do they do that?
I beg your pardon, what was the question?
Whistleblower.
Oh, if a whistleblower wants, well, they can pull one of the inspectors. You know, if there's a gentleman on the slope, if there's a fellow on the slope that's unhappy with something, he can pull one of our inspectors aside and say, you know, Chuck, I'm worried that this is bad. Why don't you go take a look at it? They can write a letter to the commission, address it to any of the commissioners. They can call any of the commissioners. They can get onto our website, and there's a contact us.
Okay.
Bob.
Your inspectors, if you and I were on the North Slope today, where would we go to find them?
Oh, I call them on their radio and say, where are you? Because they're all over. They could be at Alpine doing a safety valve inspection. They could be at Milne Point checking out a blowout preventer. They could be at North Star doing a meter proving. They're all over the place.
And do they have a main office
they
there?
They have an office, and it is in Dead Horse.
Okay. Is it manned by someone, or is it just manned as required?
It's empty.
It's empty.
The only thing waiting for them is their refrigerator and their bed.
Okay. And of those five fixing to be six, how many people are up there at any one given time?
A minimum of one, but we try to keep two people up there at all times. Sometimes with holidays and vacations, you know, you can't always have two people up there and somebody in the cook inlet, and having people taking their time off that they've worked to earn, because they do work 7 and 7. You know, they're supposed to give them 7 off after they have 7 on.
Okay.
But we try to have two. And we will never have zero.
Okay. On your slide says, key findings, BP well integrity investigation, and you have the term well cellar requirements. What's that mean?
Well, in a well house, you know, that comes up, you know, the well is down in the ground, and then there's this tree that's the set of complex valves that sits right at the surface.
Right.
That set of valves is kept in a house, which, you know, a well house, and then at the surface there may just be ground, or there may be a little hollow area around the wellhead, a little sump, and that sump may be lined and it may not be lined, and if it's lined, the lining may be impermeable, or it may have deteriorated and it may not be impermeable anymore. So and there may be a grate across the top of it, or there may be just some wooden slats to keep people from falling in. and it may be 1 foot deep, and it may be 3 foot deep, and it may be 6 inches wide, and it may be 2 feet wide. And so that's what I'm saying. You know, there's nothing out there that says you can or can't have well cellars in these different situations. But there's nothing out there that says if you're going to have a well cellar, it has to have these dimensions, it has to be lined, the lining has to be impermeable, you have to prove that it's impermeable by such and such a technique. And if you can't do so, you have to do this. Those are the kinds of things that I'm talking about.
Okay. So the term regulatory gap means not in compliance.
No. Regulatory gap means we don't have regulations telling the operator what they're supposed to do.
Are you doing them or?
Doing what?
Well, if you don't have regulations and you have an expectation for them, how do you communicate that?
Can I ask the question another way?
That's not as easy
yeah.
as it sounds.
Yeah, Senator Green's going to ask the question another way.
Okay.
Does it require legislations for you to be able to promulgate new regulations, or do you do your regulations in-house?
I'm going to defer to Larry Dietrich because this is really not a loss of reserve
right.
or downhole integrity issue. This is an environmental protection issue.
Okay.
So I'm going to defer to Larry Dietrich to answer this question.
Senator Green, through the chair, I believe if I understood the question there on the well cellar and the regulatory gap, we have no regulations that define what a well cellar is or what the dimension should be or whether or not it should or should not be lined. And the well cellars have different purposes, and that's the regulatory gap. So there are no state requirements right now on their design or construction or their function or their impermeability. Our concern with them is, of course, that sometimes you have spillage around the wellhead, and one of the things is if it's impermeable, then you avoid the contamination to the ground. That answer the question?
Yeah, I mean, I don't want to be bureaucratic, and I'm not one for massive regulations, but if you put this down and you talk about there's a gap in requirements, I mean, it's sort of kind of like, well, why do we have the gap? Why don't we reduce the gap? And I'm not trying to leap over minutia, but that bird is trying to figure out the gap, too.
But Mr. Chair, and that is something that was identified during this investigation, mm-hmm. that this gap exists. And so it is our intention to fill the gap.
Okay, good. Well, good. I think that was the answer I was looking for. I'm not sure. Thank you.
Well, but that was, trying to turn lemons into lemonade. We spent a lot of time and money looking for a set of allegations that we did not find, but we did identify this gap, and it's good that we did because now we can fix it.
Okay. Thank you, Senator Wilkowski.
Thank you. What's on your What's New Since Mid 2006 page? You say Point Thompson Gas Allowable Study on Hold. Can you explain a little bit more in depth what that means to me?
Okay, we negotiated a confidentiality agreement with the Point Thompson owners to have access to all of their confidential reservoir information so that we could determine if it would be possible to give Point Thompson a gas allowable without creating liquid hydrocarbon, an unacceptable level of liquid hydrocarbon waste. Now, we because Point Thompson isn't an oil field like Prudhoe Bay, but it's not a dry gas field either. It's something funky called a retrograde condensate reservoir. And unless you want to go through a bunch of physics, then just trust me, it does funky stuff. And if you don't understand it and produce it properly, you could lose liquid hydrocarbons in the reservoir. So we're trying to gain the understanding necessary to determine what is the best way to produce that reservoir to get the most gas and liquid hydrocarbons out of the ground. Now, we recognized it was going to be complex. We recognized that we'd need a lot of information that nobody has but the owners, and that we'd have to work a deal with them to get access to it. They were very amenable to that. We did work through to acceptable agreement, and we had our first meeting where we talked about how we were going to share data and what their thoughts are on how Point Thompson compares to other retrograde condensate reservoirs around the world. And then the DNR ruling came out holding Exxon in default, and Exxon didn't come back to us and say, you're not welcome anymore. In fact, I called them and said, is it appropriate to continue with this study, or should we just put it on hold? And they said, well, let's just put it on hold for a little while. We're not stopping it. We're not going to start all over from scratch later and make you renegotiate. But let's just let us focus on what we need to be focusing on right now, which is working through our issues with DNR. So does that answer your question?
Well, I don't want a detailed physics explanation, but I guess if I'm understanding you, Exxon came to you and asked you to put that study on hold?
Mm-hmm. No, I offered to put it on hold, knowing that they they may not have the lease 6 months from now.
And if they don't have, well, I mean, what is the state's advantage to putting that study on hold?
Well, it costs a lot of money to have reservoir engineering consultants and geophysicists mucking through a bunch of data if you're not going to do anything with that, or if a new operator is going to come in and gather new data, and then you're going to have to do it, you know, in 3 years, you're going to have to do it all over again.
I guess my only concern is with the timelines, the strict timelines we'll be under, and everyone wants to get a gas line as quickly as possible. Point Thompson is a huge reserve. I just would think that we would want to be pursuing that as quickly as possible.
You are right. 6 months to let Exxon figure out what their strategy is and if they want to continue doing this isn't going to stop us from completing our study. But you raise a very valid concern. We can't just sit here for 5 years and wait for it to be resolved. We'll have to step in, give them a little time to breathe, and then step back in and see what we want to do.
I guess I just really don't understand why we're waiting for Exxon at all, since they've been held to by the DNR to be in default. So that's just more, I guess, of a comment than a question.
Okay, I guess I'd have to talk to my lawyers, but if they own data that that they can choose whether or not to share, and they're in default, why would they share it with? I'm not sure I understand what would be their motivation to give us access to data on something that they've just had taken away from them, and all the only thing they have that has value is their data. But that, again, that's a question for the attorneys.
Kathy, we'll revisit that on another day.
Okay, that sounds good.
Yeah, good. Are there any final questions for Kathy? Kathy, you did a good job. Sorry, we didn't mean to sound like we were grilling you.
Oh, not at all.
Thank you very much. One final question, though. The note that I have here says, technically, you're under the Department of Administration. Is that accurate?
Yes, sir.
Yeah.
We have to be somewhere. And years ago, we were under the Department of Natural Resources. Mm-hmm. But that could cause a conflict of interest in some of our role, because the state has no greater standing before us than any other leaseholder.
Right. Okay. So who do you report to?
I report to every person in the state of Alaska.
Okay. Well, thanks for you reporting today.
You're welcome.
No, thank you very much. We have, Tony, we have two more reports.
Correct,
okay, and we have about 35 minutes to do that. Here we go.
I believe that's quite possible.
Here we go.
For the record, Joni Slimmons. The presentation looks like this, if you can ignore my scribbles. It does have my name in the lower right margin. Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, there are two major topics that I would like to address today. First, the activities of the Division of Oil and Gas within the Department of Natural Resources since August relative to our permitting actions and the corrective actions that BP has taken. And secondly, I'd like to take a look forward and give you a description of the Petroleum Systems Integrity Office. You might also have heard of this as LMICO, the Lease Monitoring and Engineering Integrity Coordinator's Office. To begin then, first, our permitting actions since August of 2006. There are four major permitting categories that the division has focused on and for which we've received applications from BP. jumper lines and bypass lines, especially in the first days and weeks after the spill, installation of pig launchers to allow pigging of corroded lines, and for the most part that was BP's compliance with federal compliance orders, hot taps and specimen removals. Again, many of these were BP's actions in response to federal compliance orders. And the largest of all of these, the oil transit line replacement project, which consists of various types of permitting actions and construction actions, if you will, construction of new lines on new vertical support members, construction of new lines on existing vertical support members, road crossings, and installation of pig traps and metering skids. In total, 10 authorizations have been issued by the Division of Oil and Gas Permitting and Compliance Unit since March 10th, that would be the GC2 spill. The corrective actions have been treated as a priority by the Permitting and Compliance Unit, and I believe that there has been excellent coordination between the Division of Oil and Gas Permitting and Compliance Unit and other agencies, as well as coordination with BP for all of these actions. By way of description, the traditional permitting and compliance function of the Division of Oil and Gas does have an emphasis on the land use perspective. Our authorities stem from the Alaska Lands Act. Primarily, the division implements mitigation measures to address multiple use and environmental concerns, the maintenance and integrity of oil and gas infrastructure, or systems integrity, if you will, has traditionally been left to the operators. It was believed for years that enlightened self-interest would lead operators to do the right thing in terms of maintenance. Recently, of course, we have realized that we cannot rely on that. In 2006, there were several unplanned production impacts to oil and gas. Of course, there was the March spill at GC2. In August, the shutdown of the eastern operating area and the partial shutdown of the western operating area in the Prudhoe Bay unit. In addition, and it received much less press, there was loss of a gas compressor at GC2. And then weather-related outages, which of course no one has control over, gave additional production impacts. There was a high wind situation on the North Slope. I believe the weather report said blowing snow and gravel. And it wasn't a joke. That was the weather report that I got when I called to check on one of my people. And you probably heard about the slowdown and eventual stop of flow on taps due to the high winds at Valdez. The storage tanks down there became very full, and we simply had to slow things down. There were also ancillary impacts from all of these things. The salaries and travel, for instance, of various state agencies in responding to these production slowdowns and stops. And there were impacts to taps. We've mentioned earlier the analysis of low vibration at the various passes and low throughput options and so forth. I do not have a figure on what the cost, total cost is of all of the ancillary impacts, not to mention the production itself, but it is a lot of money, I am quite sure. It became obvious as we started looking at the various elements that required the attention of state personnel, not to mention federal personnel, that maximizing the efficient and stable flow of oil and gas to market was essential. We needed to ensure that regulatory oversight was complete, and we needed to address the integrity of oil and gas infrastructure and to plan appropriately for down maintenance times. There are various agencies, as you well know, that exercise regulatory oversight of oil and gas activities. Within the Department of Natural Resources, there are four divisions or offices that address oil and gas. The Division of Oil and Gas, of course, also the Office of Habitat and Management Permitting, the Office of Project Management and Permitting, and the Division of Mining, Land, and Water. Within the Department of Environmental Conservation, there are also four divisions that address oil and gas activities: spill prevention and response, and we've heard from that director here today. Also, the Division of Air, the Division of Water, and the Division of Environmental Health are involved in oil and gas activities. We've just heard from Commissioner Forster of the Alaska Oil and Gas Conservation Commission. Also, the Regulatory Commission of Alaska is involved. The Department of Fish and Game, where oil and gas activities occur in special areas, legislatively designated areas. The Department of Labor and Workforce Development, Has an electrical inspector and a safety inspector that are involved primarily through the State Pipeline Coordinator's Office. And the Department of Public Safety has the State Fire Marshal's Office that is also involved. That doesn't even begin to address the federal agencies and the local governments that are involved in oil and gas activities. And yet, despite all of those agencies and all of those regulations and statutes, we found in August that there was actually a lack of regulation over some of the pipelines. We've heard from Commissioner Dietrich that the state is filling those pipeline oversight gaps. We know that the federal government is also filling their gaps in terms of pipelines. What is yet unaddressed is a comprehensive view of all of the facilities, not just pipelines, that are concerned with oil and gas activities within the state. The Murkowski administration issued Administrative Order 229 on October 6, 2006, as promised in the August 18th meeting at the Joint Resources Committee at the LIO in Anchorage. That administrative order formed the Lease Monitoring and Engineering Integrity Coordinator's Office. It formed a cabinet of the nine agency heads involved with oil and gas in the state, and it created an organization that looks very much like the Joint Pipeline Office, in that representatives from all of the agencies were to be co-located in a single office. DNR was heading up this organization. There were two primary goals of Administrative Order 229 and the LAMECO office, if you will. First, to discover and fill the regulatory gaps regarding oil and gas, and second, to ensure the integrity of oil and gas infrastructure within the state. Those two primary goals are important for the future of Alaska and for the future of recovery of our oil and gas resources and protection of health, human health, and environmental safety. They remain the primary goals of the new Petroleum Systems Integrity Office. Let me go back to the LAMECO. By the time the administration transitioned, several steps had been taken to implement the office. There had been some coordination among state agencies, and a formal coordination meeting was held on November 29th. Draft MOUs were developed for the Office of Pipeline Safety within the US DOT and DNR, and also a draft MOU was developed with the North Slope Borough. Four positions were established to help DNR staff the new office. So the overall purpose, those two primary goals that I mentioned, that is, filling the regulatory gaps, and then exercising oversight of ongoing maintenance effort, as proposed by the Murkowski administration, were considered by the new incoming administration to be excellent goals. However, the new administration did feel that a more focused and assertive effort could be achieved in realizing those original goals by utilizing a leaner organization, and by the way, one that is less expensive. Administrative Order 230-something, we don't yet have a number, we expect to be issued in the very near future. It does not establish a separate cabinet, but it does establish the DNR commissioner as the lead for state and federal coordination as necessary. It requires the DNR commissioner to designate a Petroleum Systems Integrity Office coordinator. That coordinator's responsibilities first are to conduct a regulatory gap analysis, an interagency effort with required coordination with other agencies. The PSIOC then will fill those gaps in infrastructure oversight. We will review, approve, and enforce operator quality assurance programs, and this follows the compliance model of the State Pipeline Coordinator's Office. The PSIOC and that office will lead the interagency efforts determined to be necessary, whether they might be coordinated enforcement actions or future coordination actions that are not yet defined. And this office will periodically report both to the governor and to the legislature on the health of our oil and gas infrastructure, on our accomplishment of the overall goals and our progress toward them. Where do we stand right now? What is our planned implementation? The administrative order is in final review by all of the designated agencies. those that I mentioned earlier that have an involvement in oil and gas activities within the state. Our staffing plan has been reduced from 10 positions within the Division of Oil and Gas to 4 positions. We hope to be hiring as soon as possible. Those positions, by the way, include technical expertise in the forms of engineers and quality assurance specialists. The first effort of the Petroleum Systems Integrity Office will be the regulatory gap analysis. Some agencies have already begun this effort. You heard from Director Dietrich that DEC is well along and perhaps completed with their gap analysis. That's one agency's input. We certainly need to collect input from all of the other 9 agencies.
What's the deadline for the analysis?
Once the administrative order is issued and we have received go-ahead for the office, we'll establish a target deadline, but my personal deadline on that is to have it finished by the end of this fiscal year, assuming we move ahead quickly.
So 1 July?
Yes, sir. Quality assurance program approval. And let me just take a moment to describe what I mean by a quality assurance program. We use that term as an umbrella term, if you will, for the various maintenance procedures, maintenance programs, corrosion prevention programs, all of the elements that operators use in order to maintain and keep their infrastructure running. Right now, we do not receive any of that information. Most operators do have various elements of that, of a quality assurance program, and most of them probably have all of those elements. We will require that they submit their quality assurance program to us. We will review it with our engineers and with the assistance of the State Pipeline Coordinator's Office engineering staff. If we find that we believe that there are gaps or risks in those quality assurance programs, we will require that they address those gaps. We will approve those quality assurance programs and provide, with that approval, transparency so that the operators know what they are performing to and our inspectors and our staff knows what we are inspecting to. We will also require the operators to submit to us annually a report on how their performance is going as compared to their quality assurance programs. And we then will report to the governor and to the legislature on the health of the oil and gas infrastructure. We intend to begin with our QA program approval at the Prudhoe Bay unit for obvious reasons. Following that, it's our intention to proceed unit by unit throughout the state. The original concept was that we would do all of the North Slope units first. I believe that that probably should be reconsidered. Some criteria for prioritization of which units should come first include the age of the infrastructure, the production volume, and the past maintenance and performance history of the various operators. Cook Inlet, frankly, concerns me greatly because of the age of the infrastructure there. Our first system integrity oversight report, as promised by former Commissioner Menge on August 18th, is due to the legislature on August 6th, 2007. That concludes my presentation. I'll be happy to take questions.
Okay, questions for Joni? Yeah, Senator Wilkowski. Yeah.
I've heard two slightly different things, actually. I don't know how slightly different they are, but you just said that if they're, as far as the quality assurance program that you have, if there are gaps, then you'll close the gaps. And in a statement we heard before, we heard, well, there's kind of a cost-benefit analysis that's done. And if things are too expensive, then we won't go ahead and do those. I don't mean to mischaracterize if that's not exactly what's said. But what is the policy here on ensuring our pipeline integrity?
Senator, through the chair, it's our intention to, first of all, determine where there are regulatory gaps, if there are any. We believe that there are. And where there are gaps, the Division of Oil and Gas, this office, the PSIO office, would fill those gaps and add it to their list of items that they would inspect, set standards for, expect performance to, and then inspect for compliance. Mr. Kojicek spoke to the fact that there's a need for balance between the degree of attention paid or degree of maintenance and so forth and the cost effectiveness of being able to produce the resource. That balance is always an issue when it comes to resource development, whether it's mining or oil and gas or whatever the case may be. There's always a fine line between what's cost-effective for the operator to do in a business sense and what is essential and must be required for protection of environmental safety concerns, and I might add for the interest of continuing production of the resource. That's an issue that we will continue to deal with on a daily basis, as does every regulatory agency within the state.
Just follow up. Do you feel comfortable that we're doing what we need to do to ensure the integrity of the pipelines in Alaska for the next generation?
Senator, through the chair, I am very comfortable now that we are doing what we need to do to ensure the integrity of pipelines. I am less comfortable, much less comfortable, that we are doing what's necessary for all oil and gas infrastructure integrity. And that's where the PSIO will be focusing itself primarily.
Just a quick follow-up. And you will provide us with a report of those areas that you feel are not being acceptably analyzed or acceptably dealt with?
Senator, through the chair, yes, I will. That will be an element of our report to you in August. Great. Is where we feel the gaps exist and what's being done about them.
Thank you.
Joni, good report. I assume that I'm looking at the person that's going to be running the Petroleum System Integrity Office. You,
Mr. Chairman, I hope you're correct.
Right. Okay. And we're rooting for you. What were you doing previously?
I manage the permitting and compliance unit of the Division of Oil and Gas, and I will continue to do so as that unit is absorbed into the PSIO.
Oh, it's going to be integrated into the PSIO?
Mr. Chairman, yes. We require those staff. They're good, experienced staff members who can supplement the small staffing that we've requested for the PSIO.
Now, if I literally interpret, I think what you said, that one time there was programmed to be 10 subordinates for you, and now there's programmed to be 4 subordinates?
Mr. Chairman.
The staff plan is reduced from 10 to 4.
The new staff for the LAMECO office was planned at 10 positions.
Right.
The new staff for the PSIO is planned for 4 positions. That's correct. That does not include existing permitting and compliance staff, which remains stable.
And how many people is that?
That's 5, sir.
Right. And these 4 people plus are people that they work for you. I mean, they have a division of attention. They're in other organizations, or they work for you?
Mr. Chairman, they work for me.
Because, I mean, your title, Systems Integrity Office, is pretty all-encompassing. You feel comfortable you can do that with 4 people?
Mr. Chairman, I feel comfortable that I can do it with 9 people.
Okay.
4 of them will be new.
Okay. And as I understand it, your budget at one point was programmed to be $1.4 million thereabouts. Is that about right?
Mr. Chairman, the overall LAMECO budget was $4.8 million.
$4.8, I stand corrected. All right, $4.8. And what's your budget now? What are you anticipating?
$0.8 million.
$0.8 million. So $4 million vaporized out of your budget.
Mr. Chairman, that's correct. Some of that money was a budget that was being requested by other agencies. Administrative Order 229, one of the administrative burdens, if you will, of that vision had DNR accepting all of the budget requests from all of the participating agencies, submitting it on behalf of those agencies, and then dispersing it via RSAs once it was allocated. That seemed to be unnecessary administrative overhead. And so some of that $4.8 million actually does reflect budget submissions that we had received from the Office of Habitat Management Permitting, Project Management and Permitting, Mining, Land, and Water, and the Department of Environmental Conservation.
Okay. And your 0.8 is, we're not going to hear in March, it's 0.6, 1 March?
No, sir. I believe that we have reached a bare-bones level for implementation of this office.
And you do not anticipate that we're going to hear from you next session supplemental?
Mr. Chairman, I try not to predict the future.
Okay. I hope no supplementals. No, we, you know, I mean, myself, as we talk about this, I mean, this is important we get this right. I mean, you have a tremendous responsibility, and I hope you can do it within that. That makes me happier than 4.8, but if you can't do it, that makes us all very unhappy, because if you can't fulfill your mission. Other questions for Joni? Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. We do have one final presentation. This is from the Department of Law, Mr. Ken Diemer, who is here to speak about the authorities, existing authorities, for the Petroleum Systems Integrity Office.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. My name is Ken Diemer. I'm an Assistant Attorney General with the Department of Law, Office of Oil, Gas, and Mining. And I prepared a very brief packet of information here, which you can see is entitled the Lease Monitoring and Engineering Integrity Coordinator's Office, LMECO or PSIO, Constitutional and Statutory Authority of Administrative Orders 229 and 23, whatever the administrative order will be designated. I won't belabor any of the material that you have listed in here. As experienced lawmakers, you no doubt recognize where a great deal of the authority comes from for the governor to put forth this administrative order. I was merely called in to determine whether or not the governor, you know, had the authority as the head of the executive branch to issue such an administrative order integrating various departments within other departments, and whether or not there was any sort of additional statutory authority that supported the governor's action, and whether or not there were there was the possibility of encroachment on other agency authority. Just to briefly go through them, as you can see, the governor's authority stems from the Constitution, Article 3, Sections 1, 23, and 24. Also, there's statutory authority that corresponds with that with respect to the administrative functions established by law that are not assigned to any department. And in that respect, the governor shall assign them to a department which, in accordance with the organization of state government, can most appropriately and effectively perform that activity. And as you heard Ms. Slim has just mentioned a moment ago, she adequately described that. Again, there's additional statutory authority under the authority and duties of the Commissioner of the Department of Natural Resources. Oil and gas and gas-only leasing statutes. The competitive oil and gas leasing provisions. And finally, it was asked as to whether or not there was any possible encroachment on other agencies' authority. And it was the Department of Law's review that determined that at this point there is none. And that's basically all I have. And if the committee would like to ask me any questions, I'd be happy to answer.
Have questions?
I have a general question.
Yeah. Senator Stedman.
I have a general question since I don't know one had a particular or direct question on the legal aspect of it. But I'm just kind of curious on the volume of the sediment in the pipe. Was it found to have, you know, a couple of coffee cans full of crud? Or are we talking yards? Or are we talking 20-yard end dumps and excavators trying to haul it away?
Senator, through the chair, I'm going to ask Louis Kozaszek to respond to that.
this is just based upon memory, and during the summer there was a lot of discussion about the volume, and the expected volumes change. So believe that in the end they hauled off about 25 to 32 cubic yards of sediment, but they also had much more solids in the form of asphaltenes and wax, and by one or two orders of magnitude more than that, and I'm not sure the exact volume that they ended up with there.
When one of the presenters was talking about, you know, the pipe, and they had some elevation changes, and it appeared to be an area where there would be buildup in those particular areas. Is there any idea of roughly how thick that sediment would be before the bacteria would start to grow and then grow to a magnitude where it could eat through the pipe? Are we talking millimeters or several inches or a foot or?
Well, theoretically, even a minor coating can provide some increased acceleration of corrosion. But I think that we're probably talking in terms of inches found at that particular site where the pipeline corroded through in August.
Could we, Mr. Chairman, maybe have BP respond to those two questions?
Yeah, Tony, you there?
Yes, sir, I'm here.
Yeah, did you hear the question?
Yeah, I think it's related to the volume of sediment in the pipes, the thickness of the sediment in the pipes.
Yes.
I'd like to actually come back to the specific numbers, but my understanding is that in the western area where we had the first leak in March, and the thickness was in the order of inches. And in the eastern area, it was very, very thin. We didn't have anything like the same accumulation of solids in the eastern area where we had the leak in August.
Pardon me, Mr. Chairman, I missed the last.
Yeah, just re-ask your question. Yeah.
No, I missed the depth of when he was answering. I didn't hear what he said.
Less than inches.
First. Okay.
Yeah, in the same vein, Tony, the business of corrosion-causing elements, are you pre-filtering?
Are we pre-filtering? I'm not familiar with that term, Mr. Chairman.
Yeah, do you have a filtering system for corrosive elements?
What we do have is we have, in the facilities themselves, they should be knocking out the solids that come into the oil transit line. So we have solids handling facilities upstream of the transit lines. In addition, we treat the oil with corrosion inhibitor and biocide upstream of the facilities themselves. So from the initial production sites, we have solids handling and bacterial kind of knockout at that stage. In terms of, I guess, filtering itself, if I could actually defer this to Mr. Hedges, he may have a more technical insight to this particular question.
Mr. Chairman, this is Bill Hedges. Tony's right. Very specifically, we don't filter, is the answer to your question. The gathering centres, their only purpose in life is to separate out all the bad components on the oil. So we expect to, in the centre, to remove gas, water, and sediments, and then we hope that pure oil, sales quality crude oil, goes into the oil transit lines. But there is no filtration.
Okay, and in the question of, I think the answer was 35 cubic yards. How many dump truck loads is that? I'm just trying to get a feel for how big the volume is.
Chairman, I understand. I'm afraid I'm not familiar with what the volume of a dump truck is. I can't make that comparison.
Well,
apologies.
I'm sorry?
Sure.
Yeah.
Most highway trucks are 10.
10, okay.
10 cubic yards.
Okay. Other questions?
Chairman, that's heaping.
Yeah, I understand. It would be running over the sides. Ken, you bring this to tell us that we should be comfortable with this organization. Is that your message? It's legal.
Yes.
We shouldn't be worried. We're not getting a workforce complaint that these people do not want to be working for Joni and it's now illegal.
That's correct.
Okay. Well, I'm glad you came. I wish you had just called us and told us that. Wouldn't have brought you here. Nice bow tie, though.
Thank you.
Yeah. Okay. Other questions. Kevin, are you there?
Yep.
Mark. Yeah, and we just wanted to wish you a good Monday and thank you. Sorry about pulling you in today on a holiday, but we appreciate your dedication to service and the rest of you say the same. And unless there are other questions or comments, further comments, we appreciate your presentation. I appreciate your stepping up in leadership, and we're adjourned.